are.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, how can you ease your money anxiety when the economy is stressing you out? James B. Huntington is here with Local Economic Perspective. Advocates are pushing for criminal justice reform for youth through the Years Project. It's a growing initiative aimed at rethinking sentencing and parole opportunities for individuals who committed crimes as teenagers or young adults. We'll learn more about the project, which is backed by emerging neuroscience. And giving your broken but beloved items a second chance and keeping them out of the landfill. Catskill Repair Cafe returns Saturday in Catskill, New York. That's coming up right after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. El Salvador's President Nayib Bukele meets with President Trump at the White House today. His country, now a key player in the Trump administration's tough line on people in the U.S. without legal status. In one high-profile case, the Trump administration has not yet provided a federal judge with additional information on a man wrongly deported to El Salvador. NPR's Shondalise Duster reports that's despite a Supreme Court order that the administration helped return Kilmar Abrego Garcia to the U.S. NPR's Shondalise Duster has more.
A Department of Homeland Security official wrote in a court filing on Sunday that there are, quote, no updates for the court on Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia. A State Department official has said Abrego Garcia is, quote, alive and secure in El Salvador's terrorism confinement center. Justice Department lawyers also argued in a separate filing Sunday that a federal court cannot compel the executive branch to engage with the Salvadoran government to facilitate his return. NPR has reached out to Abrego Garcia's attorneys for comment. They previously said the government, quote, must act without further delay to ensure his safe return. Shondalise Duster, NPR News.
As President Trump's tariffs policies evolve, the world is watching for next steps. The president says he expects eventual tariffs on semiconductors, although the administration announced at the end of last week it would temporarily exclude electronic goods like smartphones, computers, and semiconductor chips, items made or assembled in China. Richard Haass, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, says America's trading partners are standing by for possible trade-offs.
He's famous for, quote-unquote, the art of the deal, but you can always get a deal if you're prepared to compromise. And the fact that these tariffs have been put on and already there's lots of walking back creates the impression that if the United States is forced to pay a price for its policy, it will back off.
China has levied retaliatory tariffs of 125% on American goods. NPR's Scott Horsley looks at Wall Street, where stocks opened sharply higher.
Stock in Apple jumped sharply on news of the tariff exclusion, which came out late Friday. China's Commerce Ministry calls it a small step in the right direction. Even that small step may not last, however. President Trump and his Commerce Secretary say electronic products could be hit with new tariffs as part of a future crackdown on imported semiconductors. The ongoing trade war has prompted OPEC to lower its forecast for oil demand both this year and next. Retail gasoline prices have been falling in recent days. AAA reports the average price of regular gas is now $3.18 a gallon. That's down about 7 cents from a week ago, but 10 cents higher than this time last month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow is up 387 points, the NASDAQ up 263. This is NPR News. The sightseeing helicopter tour company whose chopper fatally crashed into New York's Hudson River last Thursday is shutting down operations immediately. The Federal Aviation Administration made the announcement this weekend. A family of five visiting from Spain and the pilot all died. At the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, Sunday, history was made as Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy became only the sixth person to capture golf's Grand Slam. Steve Putterman reports.
For more than a decade, Rory McIlroy had been trying and falling short of winning the Masters, the only one of the four major tournaments he hadn't won. On Sunday, he did it in a roller coaster final round. Twice McIlroy had the lead, then lost it. And on the final hole, he missed an easy putt that would have clinched the win. That forced a sudden-death playoff, which McIlroy did win. He admitted there were lots of bumps.
I didn't make it easy today. I was nervous. It was one of the toughest days I've ever had on the golf course.
When McIlroy made the winning putt, he sank to his knees and began to cry. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Augusta, Georgia.
A pet tortoise and his family have been reunited weeks after a ferocious tornado tore through parts of Mississippi. Myrtle the tortoise had disappeared after trees fell on his home in the rural Kokomo area in the middle of March. Weeks later, a neighbor found the tortoise injured and took him to the Central Mississippi Turtle Rescue. Tiffany Emanuel and her family are now nursing Myrtle the tortoise back to health. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, it's Monday and we get to check in with our own James B. Huntington for some economic perspective. He's a local author and economist here to help us out and understand what's going on in the economy. James B.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, the headline in the New York Times is stocks jump after more tariff whiplash. We'll get to some of the numbers in a little bit, but let's talk about inflation. What happened with inflation last month, and how does that sort of read the tea leaves in the economy?
Well, it dropped to the lowest point in more than 3 years. They fell. Actually, consumer prices in general fell 0.1% in March. That was mainly because of energy and food prices. Other things also did not go up as much. We have, this is the 2.8% that everything else went up, was the smallest 12-month increase since March of last year. We're moving toward the target rate. We do have a lot of concern with the up and down tariffs, what it, the effect it's going to have. They'll certainly be inflationary, although that we don't seem to have any consistency in which ones are going to last and for how long. Accordingly, we have the Federal Reserve even more likely to keep interest rates the same and not change any of them.
And we're talking about how things have been moving around. Last week was a chaotic week, obviously. Then most recently, President Trump exempted imports of smartphones, chips, and other electronics. But then yesterday said that these carve-outs were only temporary. You know, how can you ease your anxiety about money and the economy when it's stressing you out with all this back and forth?
Well, I'm getting a report that 80% of Americans in a Discover Card survey said they're worried about their money situation, inflation, everyday expenses, and the state of the economy is causing the most of that. We have two-thirds saying they would be financially unprepared if they lost their job, and the recession could have a similar effect, similar perception for over half of them. So you have six strategies here in this piece. First, adjust your perspective. Think long term. It's important to realize that stocks have been better than about everything over the last 10 or 20 years. Even year after year, it goes up. They go up more often than they go down. It's a concern, but realizing that 30 or 40% of the time, your stocks will go down in the course of a day. So that may be scary. It may seem scarier than it really is. It's not going to matter much if you are holding, if you're still continuing to hold your stocks, which I've always thought is a good idea, unless you have some specific concern, and then you might have something to think about there. Two, they call slow your roll. And that, I had to read into the content of what they meant by this. And they meant generally don't cash out for fixed rate investments like annuities because you're afraid that stocks have gone down. That's really just another way of selling stock. It may not be a good time at all. This is a perception people have that they have to sell stocks when they go down, and that often can be the absolute worst idea, especially now when it's jumping up and down and everything seems to want to rebound and then go down, up and down. So it's certainly not going down forever, and we don't have a lot of reason for long-term pessimism here. Third is don't look at your balances. Really don't. Well, that's easier said than done. If you have a choice, if you can stand not looking at them every day, that would be healthy. If you can try at least only once a week, or if you're only looking now every month or 3 months or even year, then stick to that. It's an especially good time to keep habits of not looking at your balances, because the short term can often be deceiving. Number four, imagine the worst, and that really corresponds to be prepared. What would you do if your stocks went down to, say, half of what they're worth right now? Think about what you would do. Have a little what-if exercise. What would you do if you end up losing your job and it takes a while to find a new one? What kind of things could you do to deal with it? Fifth, identify one move, and that is just by finding one thing you can do, preparing for a job market that you don't want to be in, but you could possibly in, looking at ways of cutting spending. You can't control what these stocks are doing every day unless your initials are DT. So don't give yourself a hard time. And that leaves to number six, practice self-compassion. Don't blame yourself. People are not precognitive, and they're not able to sell before the prices go down unless they have illicit information. So just realizing that you're doing the best with what you knew at the time, what you know at the time, is a good thing, and it will help you tolerate these things more.
Practice a little self-care if you're getting stressed out about the economy. Always good advice. Let's talk about the Fed. Susan Collins, head of the Boston Fed, said that the Federal Reserve would be absolutely prepared to deploy its firepower to stabilize financial markets should conditions become disorderly. What is the Fed doing to help businesses with recent events?
Well, it's doing something different, what they haven't been doing. I haven't known them to do at all. And they are going around the country and talking with people with certain businesses and finding out what is bothering them. What are they most worried about? Is it getting employees? Is it borrowing money? Is it sales could dip down? They're finding out and compiling this information, and they can act on some of these things if they see patterns here where there are a lot of problems. They're not all the same from business to business. Sometimes they're having trouble getting supplies and such with the tariffs already causing some confusion and some hassle, even if they haven't really taken effect yet. But different things. So they are out there. They are concerned. They may be able to do more than just raise or lower interest rates. They may be able to come up with programs and such if they're finding out what the real pain points are for businesses now. So expect more. Expect more information from them in, say, the rest of the year.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to James B. Huntington, local economist and author, for some local economic perspective. Let's talk about the intersection of science and the economy. Why are we at risk of losing a generation of scientists?
Well, there are problems with jobs, problems with how many positions are available because there is research funding with all the federal cuts and the government efficiency efforts. They're hurting a lot of jobs for scientists, many of which are subsidized or backed up by government money. So there are not as many of them there. Now, realize that the whole STEM thing has been oversold for a long time, that it's true that the careers are good, but there have been more and more people getting into them, and there are not always as many. So don't guilt yourself if you're in college and you're finding out that science or technology or math or engineering is not your thing, because it's not going to work for everyone. There are a shortage, especially one bottleneck is traditionally in the sciences, people have got a PhD and then become a postdoctoral fellow or having some postdoctoral opportunity. And those don't pay very much. Often they're just the minimum wage plus benefits like health care. But when there are fewer of them, that causes people to lose a credential that they will need for the professor, the regular professor jobs, and a lot of private sector research opportunities if people know you can do it. So it will not be as good as people said it was still, and it may be heading for hard times in these fields in general, especially if the jobs that are provided by taxpayers, governments, money, or allowed to be possible, if more of them end up disappearing, these fields really won't be able to tolerate that well.
Well, it could also mean America's demise as a powerful force for innovation in science, health, and technology, and some other competitors.
Yes, we could have something of a reverse brain drain if this kind of thing really continues. People going to countries where the demand for people in these fields is higher, and they're not turning out as many as they are here.
Some countries already beckoning these scientists as well. Let's take a look at the numbers. As I mentioned at the top there, stocks had jumped this morning. What's the latest and latest on other numbers? How do they change?
Okay, we'll give you the most recent one I have here. It's probably on about a 10-minute delay. The NASDAQ is a little bit short of 17,000, which means that it's about 1,500 up from very early a week ago Monday morning. The Dow is 40,578, which is a gain of 300 and some to add to the 1,900 it went up over the past week. Also looking good. Gold is 3202, which is still up 180, even though it's down 29 for the day, it's up about 180 for the last week plus. Silver, 3204, hasn't changed much, but that went up $1.77 from early morning to early morning. The ratio is over 100-1, which is historically quite high. So that might mitigate toward buying silver, but then again, the world is changing, and gold may have a high priority of things. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 61.64 early this morning, up $2, but still way low by the standard of the past few years. We're still waiting at the pump. We're not seeing those price reductions. We better soon.
Yep.
Bitcoin, 84,383 early this morning, and almost the same right now. It's gained 8,000, so that's higher than 2 weeks ago, but it's still lower than it was 3 weeks ago. The pound and the euro were up about 3 cents and 4 cents over this week stretch. The dollar is weakening. There's no doubt about that. A lot of concerns, people buying other money. $1.31.6 for the pound, about 1.14 for the euro. Those are quite high. And the Japanese 100 yen may have hit a multi-year high at 70 cents. So we're looking at a great deal of volatility. We still have these daily changes and things that investors don't know how to interpret, things that may happen. So hang on. So I recommend you play what you have.
All right. James B. Huntington here with some economic advice and local economic perspective and local therapy, it seems, at these times. Thank you so much for being here on Monday, and we'll see you next Monday for another round of this, we think. Thanks, James B.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, advocates pushing for criminal justice reform for youth through the Years Project. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we look at what it means to claim the identity of Latino and Latina in 2025. Should Latino be a racial category, or is Latinidad a fiction? And how do we answer these questions when simply existing as a Latino today can make you a target? That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Mimi. Just wanted to say thank you to the more than 400 folks who have donated during Radio Catskill's Spring Fund Drive. If you were one of those listeners, thank you so much. And if you haven't given yet, there's still time. We need your support now more than ever. Donate now at WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and I want to add my thanks to you as well. Legal advocates with the Years Project are calling for sweeping reforms in how New York's criminal justice system treats young people convicted of serious crimes. In a recent op-ed published in the Times Union titled, quote, "Give Young Offenders a Path to Redemption," attorneys Allison Haupt and Barbara Zolot argue that the system has failed to evolve in step with modern science and that it's time for a change. The Years Project is short for Youth Empowerment and Reentry Support. It's a growing initiative aimed at rethinking sentencing and parole opportunities for individuals who committed crimes as teenagers or adults. Backed by emerging neuroscience, the project highlights that human brains, especially the parts governing judgment, impulse control, and risk assessment, continue to develop well into a person's mid-20s. Haupt and Zolot represent clients who were sentenced to decades, even life, behind bars for crimes committed when they were as young as 16. Radio Catskill's Patricia Rubio recently sat down with Allison Haupt and Barbara Zolot to learn more about how they advocate for second chances, restorative justice, and policy reforms that reflect a deeper understanding of youth development.
YEARS stands for Youth and Emergent Adult Resentencing Project, and its mission is to attain reduced sentences for people who committed their offenses when they were little more than children and were sentenced decades ago to really astronomically long sentences. By way of a little background, Allison and I are both attorneys at the Center for Appellate Litigation, which we refer to as CAL, which is a nonprofit criminal defense organization in New York City that was formed in 1997, and I confess I was there at the beginning. Flash forward, in 2020, I started the Years Project because I was really haunted by clients whom I had represented years before, some when Cal first opened its doors, who were very young teens and young adults when they committed their crimes and were sentenced to these astronomically long sentences, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years and more for crimes committed when they were so young. As I moved through my life and my career, and of course grew with life circumstances, I was very acutely aware of Cal clients who were still serving those life sentences in prison, who I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt had also changed with time and with life circumstances. And I really wanted to find a way to bring those clients back into court so that they could show the court who they were today and to argue for a reduced sentence based on who they were now. And from that desire and effort, the Years Project with Allison as my partner was born.
In Years, what we do is we show the full story of our clients' lives. We get to show the remarkable rehabilitation that so many of our clients have undertaken, as Barbara mentioned. But we also get to show the story of their lives before this crime, the story that too often was never understood by the sentencing court, because although defense attorneys are obligated to investigate the circumstances of their clients' lives, especially a young person, what we see time and again is that lawyers were not undertaking that investigation. We're not sharing this information with the court. And so what we do in Years is we work with mitigation specialists. Those are experts with sometimes a social work background or an investigator background, with the expertise to pore through the details of our clients' lives, to go through records that prove abuse, neglect, exposure to violence, what we see across the board, sadly, with our clients, proven through records, ACS records, family court records, school records, but also through interviews with our clients, with their family members, their co-defendants, who can explain what's the context in which all of this occurred. It doesn't justify the bad decisions that our clients made as children, but it definitely explains it. And it gives us reason to believe that if you can understand this and move past it, we don't need to incarcerate these young people for the rest of their lives. And so through this full arc, the person that the court should have known, that child at sentencing, and the person they are today, that's the basis by which we come back into court.
So this, I guess, is the motivation why you want to focus on young people, because of the science showing that the development of the... Well, let's talk about the science a little bit behind this, the neuroscience behind a young person's brain.
Sure. There's been great advancement in our understanding of juvenile and emergent adult brains, probably in the last 15 years or so, where we understand that brains are continuing to grow well into our 20s. And the area of their brain in particular that's continuing to grow is the area that's related to judgment, to decision making. And what the science proves is that young people, their brains make it so that they're less likely to consider the consequences of their actions. They're more likely to be rash. They're almost predisposed to engage in reckless behavior. I think some of the literature says they're hardwired to engage in reckless behavior, especially in what's called hot cognition, when your emotions are arousing you in a period of time that's fast-paced or exciting or scary. And those are the very circumstances that our clients often find themselves in at the time that they committed the crimes that led to their incarceration. There's actually a judge on one of the appeals courts who said that young people just do not have the same brain capacity as adults. They just don't. But because our brains are growing, that means that young people also have incredible capacity to change. It's what the case law makes very clear, that as that brain grows, as we're better able to consider consequences, we become different people. And we see that in our own lives. We see that in the way that we've changed, as our children have changed, our family members have changed. And we see that with all of our clients as well. And so in the law, if young people are different than adults, then we need to punish them differently. If they're less able to think about the consequences of their actions, then the court says that they're less culpable because the decision making, or really the lack of decision making, is because of an immature brain and not because of malice, not because they're permanently incorrigible. If they're capable of rehabilitation, it means that we don't need to incapacitate them for the rest of their lives. And punishment is actually meant to be about rehabilitation. That's one of the purposes of punishment. And so for a young person, we know that they can reach that rehabilitation far sooner than somebody else. There's actually something called the age crime curve. And you see this drop off in line with the brain science, that people are less likely to engage in that kind of behavior as they grow and mature.
But that's brains for young people across the board. Now you throw into like childhood trauma and the environmental impact on a young person's ability to make decisions. How does that play into it? Like childhood trauma and their current situation when the crime was committed?
So the research shows that, yes, across the board, young people are capable of change, and that trauma can further impact that process. It can further impact the way in which somebody is growing and maturing. And we see across the board with our clients the way that trauma influences their actions. The Supreme Court actually talks about this. Young people are less capable of extricating themselves from their circumstances, the very communities, their home lives where they're experiencing this trauma. And that's one of the reasons why we need to treat children differently. And we see all the time in our mitigation investigations, the way in which our clients' lives, the things that they've been through, influences their reaction to things, often their very poor reaction to things that may have led to some of their criminal activity. And that's actually what we try and express in the op-ed that you mentioned in the Albany Times Union through the lens of one of our clients in years, because he, like so many of our clients, experienced just incredible hardship as a child. His home was filled with drugs, with people using drugs, selling their bodies for drugs, incredible violence in his community, outside of his window, inside of his home. And that chaos led to him reacting in chaos, led to him expressing a lot of anger and not knowing what to do with that, not being taught how to handle that anger or those feelings of worthlessness. And you start looking for acceptance in all the wrong places. And that's sadly a universal story we see with so many of our clients, but one that when they come to terms with it, often through the mitigation investigations that we do in years, it's incredibly painful, but healing, because they understand, where did this come from and how do I overcome it?
And when we approach our investigations and our work for our clients, we see it as the traumatic circumstances that they suffered and that so contributed to their enmeshment in their wrongdoing, in a way kept them from becoming the person that they otherwise would have been. So when they're separated from that and when they're given a chance to flourish and grow, we think of it in a sense that they are transforming, but in another sense that they are really rediscovering the person that they would have been all along had they not been so damaged by these circumstances that many of them had absolutely no control over because they were just children.
Now, you both worked with clients who have been incarcerated for decades. Can you share a story that sort of illustrates that kind of transformation that you have seen, that you've talked about in the op-ed?
Absolutely. One client that comes to mind for me was 16 when he committed his offense, which was a non-homicide offense that involved recklessly firing a gun at a rival group of boys in fear that if he didn't fire, they'd shoot him first. This was a time of tremendous violence in his community. This was a time when drug dealers were really the primary and only role model for young boys, primarily black and brown boys like my client. There are many circumstances that in his upbringing that explain how he came to be running around with a gun when he was 16. But in answer to your question, my client's description in conversations that I've had with him of his understanding of manhood then and his conception of it now really illustrates the transformation for me. Back then, my client equated being a man with being tough, with being callous, with being indifferent to pain, his own and others, with never showing fear. He thought to win respect and status and, in a sense, safety, he needed to fight and confront and never, ever walk away. Now, with the passage of time and his own hard work, he understands that the decisions that he thought he was making from a place of toughness, he was actually making out of fear. He understands now that manhood is the opposite of being super aggressive, and he wants to convey this to his own young son and bring that message back to his community if he has a chance, that instead of using violence and aggression to solve a problem, being a man means to, and these are really his words, being a man means walking away. It means apologizing. It means explaining to someone, hey, you just hurt me. What you did caused me pain. Communicating. And he talks really passionately about not repeating the mistakes that of his own upbringing and raising his own son in love and not in fear and anger. And he's shown this not just with words, but in such concrete ways. He spent 7 years as a nursing assistant in the hospital prison ward, caring for the most sick and dying with incredible compassion and empathy, really understanding both the sanctity of life and the finality of death in a way that when he was young and trying to have this sort of tough exterior, he did not appreciate or understand.
Yeah. It makes me wonder that him doing that job, if the conversations he might have had with the folks who are near death and what they were saying about their lives, I wonder if that has affected him also.
That the whole experience had a hugely transformative effect. And in fact, work in prison hospital wards has been written about as being extremely redemptive. And in part, that's because, as has been written and as he has expressed, when he thinks about how close he came to killing other people and he sees these men on the verge of death, it's this sort of realization of, who was I to do that to someone else? He really sees mortality, really understands the fragility of life in a fundamentally different way.
So if Second Lack, let's say, for hypothetical reasons, if it was enacted today, let's say today the governor signed it, it's in law today, what would happen? What would happen to those individuals right now incarcerated?
Second Look legislation.
Yeah, Second Look, yes.
Okay. Second Look legislation refers to laws that give the courts an opportunity to review sentences after someone has served a very lengthy period of time. And as you've suggested, New York does not at present have Second Look, although it was introduced in the legislature today. And although I'm not an expert in the ins and outs of the bill, years takes a different approach. Mm-hmm. Absence of Second Look legislation. If Second Look legislation were passed, so many people who have made this transformative change and could show their rehabilitation, who have served already a great number of years, would have the opportunity to go back into court and make their case to a judge. As really, I want to emphasize, at least have that opportunity, like my client, who we're now working to find a path for him to get his sentence reduced using our years theories. Second Look would be another path to doing that.
So how does a person, what does true rehabilitation look like? How do clients just demonstrate that? You mentioned working in the hospital is one way.
Okay. More broadly speaking, I think that what we found is that the rehabilitative journey, I should say, is different for every person and the timeline is different. But one common theme we've seen in our clients who we are absolutely sure pose absolutely no public safety threat and do not need to be imprisoned any longer, is a true and deep reckoning with the harm that they've caused. The client I just mentioned, for example, who's such a good example, has taken full accountability, not just for the harm he caused to the victims who were injured, but beyond that, to his community who was put in fear, and even beyond that, to people he doesn't know, to kids who came after him, who might have looked up to him as a role model and might have followed in his footsteps. And he takes responsibility for the harm he caused by influencing them to get on that wrong path.
We've also seen clients who really embrace this idea of rehabilitation, taking the time to grapple with the root cause of why they got in trouble in the first place, to understand what was it that made the street life so alluring that they really lost sight of right or wrong, lost sight of what it means to be a man, to be a contributing member of the community, and instead falling into these traps of, you can't be disrespected, you need to be tough, you need to be accepted in this one version of how you get out of your circumstances. And the clients who really work to understand their anger, understand the abuse that may have led them to the streets, those are the clients we see as most successful, because they're also able to say, okay, if I'm exposed to something like that again, I know I'm going to react differently because I know why I reacted that way in the first place. And that's something that they're able to do with the support of programming in prison, but also just through their own deep reflection because of that remorse that they express and not wanting to be that same person again.
Now, you mentioned, Barbara, you mentioned that right now you are searching a path for your client. What legal paths are currently exist, if any? And if someone who's serving decades who's looking to seek a reduced sentence, what can they do? What have you done so far?
That really is what our year's project is all about. And what we do is, as Allison had said in the beginning, and I'll let her pick up with that, we really work to get back into court to show the court the full trajectory of our clients' lives. We do that by presenting legal theories to the court. In contrast to Second Look, where anyone who, as I understand it, anyone who has served a certain amount of time would have the opportunity to make the application. In the absence of Second Look, years finds legal defects that we can identify that allow us to come back into court. And Allison can talk more about that.
Because there's no dedicated statutory mechanism to come back into court and say, just solely based on the amount of time that I've served and the person that I am today, my sentence needs to be looked at. What years does is we identify viable legal claims that explain why these sentences are illegal. So as I mentioned, because defense attorneys are obligated to investigate the circumstances of their clients' lives, that courts need to understand the context in which these crimes occur. They need to understand the person that sits in front of them. It's not just the crime, but who's this human being and what punishment is necessary for that person. We bring challenges to our client sentences because their lawyers failed to investigate. They failed to identify all the things that we are able to identify, even 20, 25, 30 years later, because our clients have all served that amount of time before we work with them in the Years Project. And even still, after all that time, we're able to uncover all of this information that a court should have known. And had a court known, it's reasonably likely that the sentence would have been different. This brain science that we keep talking about that also fundamentally affects a sentence. If young people's brains do not allow them to think like adults, then the courts say that we can't punish them as we punish adults. And so we challenge sentences under theories arguing that they're cruel and inhumane under the Eighth Amendment. We see that in case law all the time. The Supreme Court has prevented the death penalty or most circumstances of mandatory life without parole for people under 18. And so challenging under these theories, lots of states are expanding that. And that's what we do in years, is we are working to expand our understanding using the brain science to challenge these sentences. And it's something that we do in years, but that we hope lots of lawyers start doing. There are so many people across the state, far beyond the clients that we're able to work with in years, who would benefit from mechanisms like these.
And of course, the explosion in brain science really happened after our clients were sentenced. In a sense, what we're really doing is coming back to court, to the court, with information the court didn't have at the time. A sentence needs to be based on reliable information and a full consideration of relevant factors. And certainly the brain science is an extraordinarily relevant factor. So part of what we're doing is saying to the court, look, it might have made sense to you then, really wouldn't have made sense to us even then, being defense attorneys, but it might have made sense to you then, judge, but you didn't have the benefit of this information. And now with this information, you should look at this person before you differently. So yes, we challenge the sentences on various angles, but also making up for a deficiency in information that the court didn't even have available to it then. It wasn't in the judicial consciousness then.
And not just even not available, but a completely opposite perception. So many of our clients were sentenced at a time when the super predator myth was filling everybody's understanding of juvenile justice. And so thinking that youth was not mitigating, but actually aggravating, that young people, and we saw that particularly with clients who are Black or Brown, who had this, the literature shows this adultification, failing to see our young clients as young, and viewing them as exceptionally violent and capable of change, when in fact, it's the exact opposite. The brain science shows that myth, which has been thoroughly debunked, is really the exact opposite.
And that was Patricio Rubio speaking to the folks at the Years Project, Allison Haupt and Barbara Zolot, about how they advocate for second chances, restorative justice, and policy reforms that reflect a deeper understanding of youth development. You can hear the full interview on our website, wjffradio.org. We'll take a break and back with more. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
This is Cooper R. Grace, KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Radio Catskills Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. 2 hours of great music, jazz, funk, blues. I got mellow grooves to help you unwind, exciting rhythms to help you cut loose. Join me Tuesday night for the Music Emporium, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll bring you that Catskill Repair Cafe story tomorrow. But now, one of our favorite stories recently, memories of the Kentucky Club. Jimmy Givens on growing up in show business and the magic of the Catskills.
In Woodridge, the Kentucky Club was on the corner. It was a corner building. It was beautiful. And right across the street from the Kentucky Club was what we call the Prager Building, which belonged to Sam Prager. We called him Max. He had the grocery store up front and apartments upstairs that faced the Kentucky Club. So when my folks were over there, or any of the entertainers that were there, I could hear what was going on right across the street. And one of the best things about the Kentucky Club was the Chinese food. They had a menu, something fierce. And when my folks would get done, they'd come back across the street and bring me some of those delicious Chinese ribs. Oh, man. Yeah.
You refer to the Kentucky Club as the most influential yes. place in your life.
Yes.
Can you describe the atmosphere of the Kentucky Club a little bit more and
sure.
what made it so special to you?
Well, to me, I'll get to that to me part because there's a date that's very special to me. But it was the atmosphere being there, not to say the Kentucky Club or for me, anywhere in Woodridge. Small town, back in the day, everybody knew me. I was Givens and Sweetie's son. I could go. People were inviting me into the swimming pools and Proyek supermarket, everything.
Givens and Sweetie, your mom and dad.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's right. Thank you. And just to be in the place, everybody knew me. The entertainment, the nightclub, the bar was up front on the main drag there. And you had to walk all the way into the back, into the dining area, and then like the nightclub, which is where the stage was. And in the book, there's a picture of my parents performing on that stage. And I had to make a note, and it's difficult to see because the picture is so old and it's all dark, black and white and dark. You can't see the wheels that were on the stage. The stage pulled out for the show from underneath the bandstand. And then the entertainers worked on the stage. It was in for dancing. Plenty of room for everyone to dance. And when you go back towards the bandstand, on one side was the dressing room for the ladies. And then in back of the bandstand, which was a backdrop, had a curtain, the fellas walked over here to the other side. And the facade over the stage, here and down, and the lights. They had black inserts of dancing figures and music notes and everything like that. It was my life. Now, you asked about what is so special about the Kentucky Club for me. Saturday, July 10th, 1965. That's the key right there. That is the night this comedian was born because my daddy couldn't be there to run the show because my folks were always working, popular, in demand, and acts did 2 and 3 shows a night, different hotels. You get done here, you run over there, all right? So once he found out what was going on, he told Max Kurtz, the owner, he says, I'll get there late. Jimmy's going to MC the show. And it was getting later and later. And no Gibbons and Sweetie. I'm looking at the door. I don't see nothing. We had a good band. We had a trio. A belly dancer. Oh, yeah. So I'm utilizing all of the talent that I've got available.
But you're kind of vamping, waiting for mom and dad to show up.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Improv is fun. You fail to plan to fail, but not when you're doing that. And the audience was cool. They were cool with it. So I said, here's Phil Williams. He played a couple of numbers, lay down on the floor, kicking his feet up in the air, playing sax. Gilles did pantomime. The drummer did pantomime. He was from Montreal. Now it's time for the belly dancer. Here she comes. Do-do-do-do-do-do. And she did her thing. It's really getting late. It must have been around 2 o'clock in the morning. The folks were hanging out. Everybody's excited. And all of a sudden, I look, coming through the door. There's my daddy with the cocktail drum on his shoulder. Mama's following him. He walked past the stage. He looked up at me. He said, 5 minutes. I said, okay, daddy.
How old were you?
13.
Wow.
He meant they'll be on stage in 5 minutes. You had to fill that 5 minutes.
Right.
Did you fill that with
of
comedy?
Course.
Your own
of course.
Routine?
Yeah, why not? Shtick. See, it's all about the shtick. I'll give you an example. You mind if I give you an example?
Please do.
All right. These two bubbies, Jewish grandmothers, are having a conversation about their respective grandsons. The first one says, my grandson, he went into the military, and in 90 days, they made him a second lieutenant. And the second one, not wanting to be outdone, she says, my grandson went into the military, too, and in 3 days, they made him a court martial. That's the kind of stuff we had up in the Catskills. Yeah, and the comedians, London Lee, Joey Bishop, all of these comedians were in all of the hotels. And some even performed in the bungalow colonies. Somebody from one of the bungalow colonies approached my daddy and says, you know, we'd like to have you at our bungalow colony, but, you know, we don't have like what they have here. So my daddy got a piano player, that cocktail drum, and my folks got in the bungalow colony, performed. People had a great time. Once the agents got wind of this, they saw a new market for booking acts. And that is how it
became
happened.
The Vorspiel circuit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Completed it.
But back to that day on July 10th, 1965, there you are, 13 years old, filling time with your shtick.
Yes.
And how did that moment shape your path in comedy and performance?
It made me know I can do it. Simple as that. It had to be in me, being surrounded, if you will, raised by my parents in show business.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Gibbons and Sweetie, mom and dad,
right.
performers
right.
in their own right, they influenced your perspective on entertainment.
Absolutely.
What did they teach you about show business?
How to perform, how to be professional, and how to leave everything you have on the stage. Every show. And it doesn't matter whether you got 10 people to perform for or 100 or 1,000 people. You work the same for those 10 people as you do the 100 or the 1,000.
Your book, Memories of the Kentucky Club, delves deeper into these experiences that you had. For somebody who maybe didn't experience the Catskills era firsthand, what do you hope they'll take away from this book?
A time capsule. They're my memories, they're my experiences, but they are what life was like in the 50s, mid to late 50s, through the 70s, as far as my parents, because we lived in Lakewood from 63 up until my folks passed away. And we saw changes in the Catskills and Lakewood. Lakewood was a winter Jewish resort. The Catskills, the summertime. And the reason we moved to Lakewood from Brooklyn, the choice was either Lakewood or the Catskills. Lakewood offered 9 months worth of work as opposed to 3 months up here. That was a big decision, big factor in my folks' decision. And once we let the folks, the hotel owners in Lakewood know that we were here, they worked my folks. Ooh,
and they were constantly booked.
Yeah. And I ended up getting a job in the Capitol Hotel by a fluke. The regular drummer didn't show up on a Friday night at 8:30. Phil Schilling, who was the leader at the Capitol Hotel. He calls my father. He says, Jimmy, Paul Taylor didn't show up for rehearsal at 8 o'clock. What am I going to do? So my father told him, he says, why don't you give Jimmy a shot? You think he can do it? He says, you lead him and he'll follow you. It's 8:30. By 8:45, I was showered and downtown doing a talk over, dance music at 9, 10 o'clock was the show, 11 o'clock was the tea room. And the first act I ever played other than my parents was a cantor from Brooklyn named Jerry Holland. And the first arrangement he had that I ever played other than my parents was a song called Granada. Great, great piece of music. And from that day on at the Capitol, I held that job for about 7 years through college and everything like that. I just had a jolly good time. Yeah. And then things changed in Lakewood once gambling came into effect in Atlantic City.
Looking back, how do you think the Kentucky Club and the Borscht Belt, that Catskills era, how do you think that scene influenced entertainment in general beyond just that time and place?
Oh, definitely. David Brenner, the comedian David Brenner, any of the comedians that you know without me being able to try to remember them all at one time.
Well, you mentioned Joey Bishop.
Yes.
And there's all kinds of
folks. Oh, yeah, Buddy Hackett. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mama couldn't stand Buddy Hackett. He did something to her, and boy, she laced into him.
What did he do?
I don't remember, but it wasn't good. And London Lee, I do remember London Lee vividly. In 1963, we were at a summer in the bungalow colony. Jack Siegel was a booking agent. In fact, in my book, his son, Mort Siegel, wrote the foreword.
You mentioned the Kentucky Club being so influential and the entire area being so impactful on you. Is there a particular moment or a particular person beyond that July 10th, 1965, birth of your comedic career that stands out most in your memory?
I have to say kind of like several people, but not entertainers. All right. Proyect's fruit and vegetable stand, Jack and Anna Proyect. David and Sylvia Rashkin's pharmacy, and all of these people are in Woodridge. The movie theater, which is not there anymore. You go down the hill from the Kentucky Club, go up and around past Highland Avenue, go up that way. There was a movie theater on the left. And, we also, these are not businesses, but these were friends of mine that I grew up with in the grocery store, over the grocery store of Max's building, the Jamroz sisters, Patty, Beth, and Fran. And Beth is the blonde in the book of a picture of she and I, and Franny was standing in the background when we were 7, 8 years old. So that's around 1959. The three of us, we played all the time. There were, I'm thinking about Sullivan's Department Store up here in Liberty. Oh, my daddy took me there and bought me a beautiful baseball glove. Uh-huh. And I just thought I was something special. I couldn't wait to get back to Woodridge because the back of the Prager building was a deep parking lot, but it's all filled in now. It's raised up. But that's where us kids used to play, and just it was a fantasy. Yes, it was fantasy world, but it was my world.
It was a special time, a special place.
That will never be duplicated, replicated, whatever word you want to cater. It will never be again another Kentucky Club, just like the and Woodridge Catskills, as there will not ever be another Lakewood.
Where can folks find your book?
My book is available on paperback and Kindle on Amazon.com.
And before we go, I want to just ask you, as someone who grew up with all these world-class entertainers, including mom and dad, would you have any advice for aspiring performers today?
Have a backup. And this is
straight talk.
Yes, I was taught this. I'll tell you something. Muhammad Ali said the same thing. He says, if you think you're going to be a boxer, you better have a backup plan because the odds of you getting hurt are bigger than you being able to have something else to go to. See, so yeah, I went to college and took up space, but I went, and I've always been a musician, though. Thank God I've always been able to be.
That was your backup.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Always. and I love it. Wouldn't have it any other way. Music is my life, and my life is music.
Jimmy Givens, thank you so much for sharing your memories. The book is Memories of the Kentucky Club. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Same here, Tim, and thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Just enough time to say thanks. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill.